Well, welcome to another Comfort Reads episode. This time I am joined by a returning guest, Dan Morin. Hi there, Dan.
Hi, Seth. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Dan had joined me previously for the Vore game, and that was a lot of fun. And so I decided to ask him if he would be interested in doing Comfort Reads episode, and that was months ago. And and you kind of gave me your category of comfort reading. So before we start talking about that, Dan, why don't you just, in case anybody's forgotten who you are, introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Dan Morin. I am a sci-fi author, most recently of The Aleph Extraction, previously The Bayern Agenda and The Caledonian Gambit, which comprise the Galactic Cold War series, which is a sort of Cold War in space series. Additionally, I'm a podcaster. I co-host a bunch of shows, including the tech shows Clockwise and The Rebound. I show up a lot over on the Incomparable Network and host several shows over there as well. And I'm also a technology journalist. I write at Six Colors, which you can find at sixcolors.com. And I do a regular column over at Macworld as well, as, you know, in addition to working freelance in other places as well. So it sounds very busy when I say it like that.
Yeah, sure does.
It doesn't feel busy, but I guess it does sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, talking about busy, I remember when, I can't remember if it was just after Aleph came out, that you were kind of talking about the pay structure of this kind of thing and how much it works out to, in terms of like how much you have to actually work to get a novel going, and then, you know, what the hourly rate works out to.
Don't calculate it. It's bad. Right. I saw somebody write today that Hemingway's rate in like 36 or something was like equivalent to $1,000. It was like, no, it was a dollar a word. So if you wrote today's money, if you wrote a 1,000 word column, you would get paid $19,000. I was like, that's what I need, because I write an 800 word column every week, and I do not get paid $19,000 for any of this.
Right, right. Does it, I mean, with the book stuff, does it help psychologically to just be like, I was going to write this anyway, and so anything I get paid for it is good?
Yeah, I mean, you'd always like to make a little more and have it hit a wider audience, but yeah, I mean, it is lovely to be able to publish books at all and to get paid for it, and that is nice. Yeah. But yeah, it's always, you know, you don't think too hard about the amount of time that you spent obsessing over a detail that really isn't that important in the long term.
But you did think about it, and we have Twitter records to,
that's right,
to prove it.
For sure.
Yes. I just read The Aleph Extraction. I had previously read The Bayern Agenda and The Caledonian Gambit. Love all of them. I think they're fantastic.
No, so, thank you so much.
Good job. Yeah. And I will definitely recommend to my listeners, if you're at all a fan of the spy genre or, you know, caper movies, that kind of stuff, these will be right up your alley. So, and I think there's a connection in the latest book to your comfort reading. So why don't we start pivoting into that and talk about, what is the category for you?
The category for me is generally British mystery, like classic British mystery. I have always loved mystery stories. When I was a kid, I started reading Sherlock Holmes like very early, like, I don't know, like second or third grade. And like, I was reading Sherlock Holmes. I remember dressing up as Sherlock Holmes and all that. And as I got older, I expanded a little bit. My mother, by the way, this is my mother's fault. She is a huge mystery reader. That is like her genre. Right. She reads probably
as well, right?
Yeah, she's a librarian. Yep. Yeah. And she reads like, I swear, like, sorry, 90% mysteries. And other stuff too, but like that is kind of her bread and butter. And so I grew up, you know, being exposed to a lot of that and watching a lot of like the British mystery series of like the 80s and 90s. You know, I watched the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes and the David Suchet Hercule Poirot and all that stuff. So I kind of grew up on that at a very young age. And she quickly introduced me to stuff, you know, Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and, you know, just all the classic British mystery writers. So that for me is, it's the thing that for sure when I am like, oh man, I just don't know what to read right now. And I just want to burrow into a book and just kind of have a great time and not really worry too much. It's always, almost always, it's always a British book, almost always. I don't know why. I think it's something about the tone and whatever. It's very comforting, but it's usually a murder mystery, which does not feel like it should be comforting. And yet it is.
Yeah. the subject material, not necessarily, but just the fact that it hits, you know, the part of your brain that you need to work.
Yeah, right. It's got a formula to it, right? Which is nice and comforting because there's a pattern and it fits that. And like, if we're talking classic British mystery novels, the bad guy always gets caught in the end, right? Like, you know, the murderer is revealed and everything works out. So you kind of know in your head that it's like, And the murders, they're not generally grisly or super gory or graphic. Like sometimes right. there is a little bit of an element of like, especially Christy, I think definitely got dark in some of hers, but it's never, mm-hmm. it doesn't feel even as like brutal as some of like, you know, you look at like the Scandinavian like mysteries sometimes, yeah, which yeah, even yeah. those feel like more brutal than these.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that, in your writing, and you know, the only published works of yours that I know of are the Galactic Cold War series, that you're not writing mysteries, but it's something that you enjoy reading.
Yeah, my agent has actually been on me to write a mystery for some okay. time, and I feel like I've done when I was younger, I tried my hand at it a few times, and I just I struggle a bit with the I guess the, you know, the sort of cozy mystery genre is where I would sort of fall, because I feel like I don't want to do something that's, you know, brutal or very stark right. or whatever. I like the sort of fun classic detectives. And I don't know, I guess there's a market for that probably. I haven't figured out the right one, or I haven't figured out the mm-hmm. right detective to write or something. Cause I think that's the thing, is like the detective is so important, and you need to be able to nail that character, because if your readers are going to follow you through book after book, there better be some element there they really want to come back for.
Right. Well, and I think there is some common DNA between spy novels and mystery mm-hmm. novels, because mm-hmm. you almost always have that, you know, the double cross, the first double cross and the second double cross mm-hmm. and that kind of right. stuff. And that plays out a lot like a murder investigation or you know.
Right, right. I mean, there is fundamentally a mystery, right? And like I was talking yeah. my good pal, Anthony Johnson, who also writes spy novels. Mm-hmm. We talked on his podcast, Writing and Breathing, at one point about like the hardest part about writing sort of spy novels is like trying to remember who knows what when. And that's very right. similar to mystery novels. You got to figure out what information is parceled out. Who knows the details here, there? Where are the revelations, the twists, the turns, et cetera? And I think there's certainly a lot of that in common. And if you look at some yeah. of the early... I mean, I think about classic spy literature, too. I think about people like Eric Ambler or 39 Steps was the other one. John Buchan, I can't remember if that's his name, Scottish writer. So a lot of that classic spy novel stuff, I feel like there's often a mystery or even a murder in it sometimes, too, right? And it's like a layer over the top of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when I asked you about your comfort reading way back, you mentioned the Lord Peter Wimsey series.
Yeah.
From Dorothy Sayers.
My favorite of all time, I think, probably mystery-wise.
Okay. Nice. And so I asked you for a specific title, you know, where I should start. I think I looked and a lot of them were cheap, and you're like, well, you know, you could start with the first one or, you know, jump in here where this character is introduced. So why don't you talk about Strong Poison or Lord Peter Wimsey in general?
Yeah, Lord Peter is a character that, my mother introduced me to. She had this huge paperback omnibus of a bunch of the short stories. It was just like falling apart, I remember. And she also had all these really nice hardcovers from, I don't even know what year, probably the 60s or 70s of a bunch of these. And so I sort of worked my way through a bunch of them. And they start off very, very light. The first one, which is called Whose Body... is Lord Peter investigating a case where a body's found in a bathtub. And it's, you know, there's almost a pastiche in it of some of those classic mystery novels. Sayers is writing a little bit, certainly after Conan Doyle, who's writing in the, you know, Victorian era, and a little bit after Christie as well, I think. Roughly contemporaneous, but I think skews a little bit later. And... so, you know, there's certainly the field has been established at that point. And Lord Peter is, you know, if you want to compare him to some of your classic British detectives, you know, he is a upper class gentleman. He's a, you know, the gentleman amateur detective. He is very much a character who plays the fop, you know, like yes. a bit of a dandy. And he's very he's got a very affected way of speaking. And people take him as, you know, very. You know, very insubstantial, right? Nobody sort of thinks much of him, but he turns out to have this very sharp mind. And beneath it all, he is very, very perceptive.
Yeah, he reminded me, I pictured him as Hugh Laurie as Bertie Wooster.
Yes. No, Bertie Wooster is, there are some references. I was looking this up just the other night as I was reading it, because Strong Poison, there is a reference at one point to Jeeves. And I was like, oh, what era is she writing in compared to Woodhouse? Because Woodhouse is another one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. That was my mother's father's favorite writer. So I have that like kind of in the bloodline there. Right. And you can tell that, yeah, Lord Peter is a bit Bertie Wooster, but as if Bertie Wooster actually had some substance beneath everything.
Right.
And yeah, so I really enjoyed all these books, but I think when she gets she really starts to come into her own is with the books that introduce Harriet Vane, who is an interesting character because she Harriet Vane is a mystery writer who writes murder mysteries and is very much the, you know, what I think you would call, I don't want to say a Mary Sue exactly today, but like she is an author's proxy. She is, she is Dorothy Sayers inserting herself in the novel. And I love my favorite Dorothy Sayers bit about why she wrote these sort of Lord Peter novels and, you know, where he's got all these very, he's got a really nice car and he eats the best food and he drinks the best wine. She said in an interview once that she's like, cause I was poor and I liked to imagine being able to have all these really, really fancy things. Yeah. So Harriet Vane gets introduced in this book, Strong Poison, in which she is on trial for murder as a murder novelist. And it's a lovely bit of sort of metafiction, I think, in a fairly interesting wrinkle to the classic formula.
Yes, yes. Very much kind of the Jessica Fletcher turnabout kind of thing where she would be on trial, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
This is an interesting book because, and we should give some kind of a recap about it. And you mentioned, right, that she's on trial. And it starts off with at least a whole chapter of, as you know, Jim.
Yes.
recapping the trial up to that point, which I thought was amusing.
Yes. Yeah. It sort of runs through a whole bunch of the stuff. So you get, which is fun too, because all the, not all the evidence is given in that recap, right. But like all the details you kind of need to suss stuff out is mentioned in there. And certainly more details come to light, obviously, as the investigation continues. Right. But a lot of it is actually presented up to you up front. It's just unclear what are the salient details in the story you're being told.
It's enough there that toward the end, when everything wraps up, you don't feel cheated.
Like right, exactly. Everything was laid out for you. It was just up to you to find it, which is kind of an interesting device for sure. And I like that they sort of go through all of that and sort of, it's also interesting because it's a novel very much of its time, right? Like the whole premise of this is that she is on trial for murdering her lover and he basically refused to marry her because he didn't want to, you know, sort of, he was, you know, on the bohemian lifestyle, right? And then there's sort of like a bit of a reversal where he does offer to marry her and she throws him over and leaves. And like, so that's why she's a suspect for the murder. And of course you're thinking, well, I mean, today that wouldn't be hardly scandalous, right? Like,
yeah, not really noteworthy.
Yeah. Yeah. Big deal in the, I think this was written in 1930, I want to say or so, or
yeah.
Yeah. So a little bit different world.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the plot of it, because Lord Peter takes an interest in this because he's attracted to the defendant.
Yes. Yeah. Which
and
is
also just completely sure that she's innocent, right?
Yes, indeed. From the get go, he is convinced she's innocent. He doesn't really have any evidence. He has no reason to believe it. And that's, he even says that, I think, so much at one point where he's like, I just am convinced, right? Like, I know. And so we just have to find the proof that she's innocent.
Right.
And so it sort of sends him down this interesting case, right? Where it's like, a lot of times these books start with like the detail, right? Ah, that was out of place or something, right? Like that. Like, that was weird. Why was this happened or who did it, right? Like, and like, in this case, I think it's interesting because he gets convinced that the most likely suspect is innocent and everything proceeds from there. So in some ways you could argue it's finding the evidence to fit the story, which I think he even
fit
makes
his narrative. Yeah,
exactly. He makes a joke about at some point, like about how theories are his sort of his pet and he doesn't want, he won't hear of it to violate his theories. Right. And I think that's an interesting device for a murder mystery. It does kind of flip it on its head to have it start sort of with the trial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's almost a trope in some detective fiction where you have, you know, the detective or the investigator who can kind of just look at somebody and know, you know, who they are.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, so much of, and I think the one shame in this book, and I thought about this as I started reading it, it was like, well, the one downside to this book is that Harriet, well, not exactly passive in this whole ordeal. I mean, she is largely a character who's, you know, we get her through other interactions with characters. Like, so
yes,
conversations with Peter, but also knowing her history and sort of relating the details around this. So you don't get as much of the two of them working together on something, which is a shame, because that comes up in later books, which is more interesting because they have a great dynamic. And you get a peek at that here, where he goes into the prison and has to talk to her and also tries to convince her to marry him.
Right. I was thinking about that and thinking, if she's the author proxy, you know, what better person to understand who could be immune to Peter's charms, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because she understands that as the author.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. She knows how to disarm him.
So the other thing, as the title would suggest, of course, this involves a poisoning, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of ink spilled over, well, what was at this meal? You know, who ate what was at this meal?
Yes.
I guess that is where it, kind of what it centers around, right?
Right. There's a lot of, like, there's sort of a timeline that they're trying to work out, right? Like, when did the poisoning happen? You know, we know when he died, but we don't know at what point he was poisoned. And it couldn't have been in this point because, you know, everybody else ate that food and, like, couldn't have been that. Right. And, you know, so they're trying to track down sort of this elusive moment at which he is poisoned, not knowing anything, you know, other than, and of course, at this point, also, since we're at the trial, right? Like, the interesting wrinkle there is that all of this stuff happened months ago, right? It's not the detective coming upon the scene of a crime and then investigating the clues that are left around. He has to track down stuff, you know, that happened well before the trial he even got involved. And there's a particularly good one where he's trying to track down the contents of a paper packet in a pub in London. And they're like, sure, yeah, that'll be easy. We'll find a paper packet somewhere at a pub in London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not like it's tracing something on the internet or something.
Exactly, right. Yeah, no modern conveniences, alas.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, of course, if you're going to say that someone's innocent, you kind of have to point the finger at somebody else. And so he starts looking at who stands to benefit from this man dying, right? Other than... Right. Harriet.
Other than Harriet, obviously. And the case for Harriet is mainly one of essentially revenge, right? Like crime of passion. And so the question is there more motive to that? What else did her lover, whose name is Philip, like who else did he cross or who else stood to gain from his death?
Yeah. And so that spins out into, was there something going on in a will where he was going to benefit from? I can't even remember the details of the will.
Yeah, it's fairly
all
complex.
Is there's very... very amusing situation where an associate of Lord Peter goes in as a spiritist.
Yes.
And kind of has a faux seance in order to try to to create the conditions where she can search the house.
Yes, this is a delightful bit. So we don't get as much of Harriet, but we do get Miss Clemson, who is a delightful recurring character in this series. And she runs essentially an agency where... Peter essentially funds her typing agency, quote unquote, which is actually just she's hired all these women who are extremely perceptive and really good at certain things. And she kind of loans them out as her detective associate. It's kind of his version of like the Baker Street Irregulars, right? Where it's got like this whole like stable of really clever women. He gets placed in different like agencies and offices and stuff in order to help him get information. So he's got one like in this particular lawyer's office in this book. And then he sends Ms. Clemson to be the spiritualist. And I have to say, I have seen, there is a, if you can dig it up, I'm not sure how easy it is to find, but there are some BBC adaptations of these three, Strong Poison, Have His Carcass, and Gaudy Night, which are the main Harriet and Peter ones. And so there are some good adaptations, and that's the scenes with Miss Clemson pretending to be a spiritualist are excellent. So the actress who plays her is great. So if you can dig those up, they're well worth a kick.
Yeah, good stuff. I guess I didn't say I really enjoyed this. I've never been an enormous mystery fan. My sister had like all of the Agatha Christie's, just shelves and shelves of them. And I never really got into them other than, like you said, right, we always watched Mystery when it came out on PBS, you know, and we watched any of the Poirot or Miss Marple things that came on anytime, Mystery or otherwise.
Yes. Yeah. I was not as big into Marple until recently. My wife actually was really a big Miss Marple fan, and we went and watched a bunch of those recent series too. And those are pretty great. But growing up, I was always a Poirot fan. I love the David Suchet adaptations. Those are some of my favorites. Yeah. And I've read a bunch of those, not all of them because there are a lot, but I've read many of them. I liked, those are a couple of my other favorites, but Lord Peter, I think he's, they're much funnier, I think, than a lot of the other ones. And yeah, they certainly have the advantage. I love the classic. You know, I love Sherlock Holmes, but I think the slightly more modern take with, you know, the Christie and Sayers writing in the 20s and 30s does provide a little bit more accessibility, I think. They're a little less staid. They're a little more adventurous in terms of their character and their plotting.
Yes. I didn't take a bunch of notes on this one just because I was just enjoying reading it. But I did like, well, one thing I wrote down was when Lord Peter was talking to Miss Murchison and he asked her if she can pick locks and she says, well, no. He says, I wonder what we go to school for. We never seem to learn anything really useful.
Yeah, that's I feel like that's something I could hear one of like my mother or my aunt saying. It feels like a very a line that they would trot out. And I enjoy that he has, of course, a pet locksmith, reformed, very reformed lock, you know, basically breaking and entering man who teaches the skills when they are needed.
Mm-hmm. So can I assume, do I assume correctly that Adelaide Sayers in Alice is a reference to Dorothy Sayers?
It's a tip of the hat. Yes, she is. Like I said, one of my favorites. And I will say, I believe Sayers is a big inspiration of Lois McMaster Bujold too, in the, especially in the Miles Catherine books that come a little later in that series. Their dynamic,
I can totally see that.
Yes, yeah. Their dynamic is very much Peter and Harriet. And I think I saw at some point in one of her things, she even, in like a acknowledgement or something, or you know, she called it out specifically, saying that she loved those books, and I was like, "Yep, I totally knew it," because you can definitely see the pattern that they built there, which is lovely. I think it's great.
Yeah, now that I look back on those books, I can totally see it. Because I should mention that before we did the Vore game, I found out that my library had basically all of the Vore Kosigan saga on audio, and so I picked up Beriar. I think I did end up reading. No, that's right. It was on audio as well. Shards of Honor. And then after we did the Vore game, I went back and listened to the Vore game again. And then I did all of them over the course of like the next 9 months.
Oh yeah. They go down easy.
They do. They really do. And yeah, the stuff with Miles and Ekaterin is pretty amazing.
Especially, I mean, some of the later books in that series basically become Miles is a detective. Like that is his job later on. And essentially they are mystery novels. And I love that she manages to like take that hard pivot into like, I'm not just going to write sci-fi. I'm going to write sci-fi mystery, and I'm going to write sci-fi mystery comedy of manners and all of that. So it's, you know, you can see the influence quite clearly. And they are two of my favorite writers, and I'm delighted that they share so much in common.
Yes. Yes. What is Miles' title? Inquisitor?
He's Lord Auditor, I believe.
Auditor. Lord Auditor. That's right.
Yes.
It's been a while since I listened to the last one. So. Yeah. And actually I'm trying to think, the last couple didn't feature Miles as the,
no, the most recent two she wrote, one of them was Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen, which is a Cordelia book. And then before that, it was it's the Ivan book, Captain Vore Patrol's Alliance. And there's also a short story or a novella that is mainly told from Ekaterin's point of view called The Flowers of Vashnoi, which came out 2 years ago or so, I think.
Yep. And my library is comprehensive enough that they even had that on audio.
Excellent. So, excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to thank you because that's been tremendously entertaining. And I still have two Vore Kosigan books on the Hugo list. I'm looking forward to doing those eventually, because I've already listened to the audiobooks, but I'll go back and read those in print.
Fantastic. Yeah. I do want to mention one of my other favorite characters from the Lord Peter series, who is, of course, Bunter. Bunter is like basically Jeeves, but also with a kind of more, I don't know. There's a lot. One thing Bunter gets used for a lot is he gets sent in to talk to the help while Peter is investigating, you know, the people of the house or whatever. And oftentimes Bunter is sent in to charm the housekeeper and the maids and the cooks and something, which I always enjoy. And he's also a photographer, and which I think is a lot of fun too, because he gets to have his own little special skill set. And he is invaluable in the same way that, you know, if Bertie would basically fall into the ocean without Jeeves, you know, Peter without Bunter is basically, why even bother? And so one of the things I loved about their relationship is, and they kind of keyed in less in this particular novel, but in other ones, they talk a lot about they were both in World War One together. And I believe Bunter is his sergeant when he is an officer.
Oh,
and so they have...
Batman.
Yes, exactly. And so they have a very interesting relationship where you always get the feeling that like Bunter has seen Peter go through a lot of stuff, and he kind of, you know, he realizes that there's also some vulnerability underneath there, but it's not something that he'll really cop to unless something bad is happening. Like, there's a couple of the earlier one, especially, I think, where Peter sort of has shell shock style, you know, PTSD flashbacks or whatever, and Bunter is there to kind of help him out of it. And I always enjoyed that dynamic, because while they may be, you know, Bunter would never dream of overstepping his bounds with his employer, but they're also very good friends. And I always enjoyed that.
Nice. Yeah. So, strong poison. Definitely recommend. Lord Peter Wimsey is fantastic. I haven't read further in this series. I've read a little bit of Woodhouse as well. And so,
Yeah, Woodhouse. Yeah. There is a great like comparison there. And I really like it. I will say of the future ones, I have his Carcass, which is the next one that also features Harriet. It's the chronology is a little weird, because they sort of, I think some of the later ones, she bounces in and out. Except I read them as like a trilogy almost. And so in that case, it doesn't matter as much. You know, there are some allusions every once in a while to another case that have happened here and there. But mostly you can read them kind of any order. The Harriet ones are the only ones that matter, because in order, because they have their relationship progresses throughout the course of their mysteries. So, and then Gaudy Night, which is some, I think, would probably consider her like sort of magnum opus. It's A, it's quite long, and B, a lot of it is told from Harriet's point of view as well. It's mostly a story about her investigating a murder at her college at Oxford, like when she goes back there sort of for like a reunion, and Peter sort of dips in and out and helps her investigate the story. But it is also, it's got a lot of tinges of romance in there too, because that is sort of the biggest book that deals with their relationship together.
I like that they didn't wrap it up neatly with a bow in Strong Poison.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's important. I think that's where you see Sayers's role is, like, what's fascinating to read that from this point of view is that you have, as with Christie to a certain extent, you have a female, you know, writer writing a male detective. And in this case, as we talked about, like pursuing a woman who is also kind of a proxy for the author. But you have to, I just enjoy the representations of some of the like sort of gender politics, I think, even of the era. Like Peter comes across as, I think, very modern and liberal, right? Like he is a he is a gentleman, but he is also not one who is like, you know, doesn't treat women like delicate flowers or anything like that. I think he is very clearly like, you know, one of the reasons he's so attracted to Harriet, and though she is frequently described as not very attractive, which is also like a weird thing to think about when you're like, I'm the author inserting myself in the story and describing myself as not very attractive. Okay, this is very strange. But he is attracted to her intellect and like her, you know, her sort of sharpness. And I think it's interesting to see how a female writer of that era presents the relationships between men and women, and, you know, the fact that Peter is a more, you know, liberal man socially, I think, comes out a lot. Like, you can also, on the downside, like, there are definitely a few allusions here and there where are dated in terms of, like, not as much in terms of race stuff, but there is some, like, I noticed one or two comments about Jews, for example. It's like, it's a little bit verging towards the stereotype, but it's, you know, it's of its era.
Yeah. So in addition to the kind of the gender politics there, there's also some class dynamics that he's much more liberal about, because I think there's a friend of his who's a policeman who's sweet on his sister.
Yes.
And he's just like, just go for it, you know?
Yes. In fact, his main concern is just that, like, he's like too gentlemanly. He's saying, you got to propose to her. And he's like, oh, I don't even know if she's interested. We've only been out to dinner like a few times or whatever. Yeah. And he's like, no, you got to ask her. You can't just string her along like this. You know, I'm being trying to be a good brother, but also I really like you. You're like my best friend and it's my sister and it's a little weird, but okay.
Don't want it to be weird. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he has to argue to the rest of his family later on. And I think that's sort of one of the key points is like, well, you know, she's just marrying the police officer. I proposed to the woman who had been accused of murder, you know, just you're softening the way for me.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I think, you know, we can wrap up the discussion of Strong Poison there. And I do want to give you a chance to plug your work. Can you give people an idea of what the Aleph of Extraction is?
Sure. Yeah. So it is a... essentially, it's a caper set on a luxury starliner. So think of it like going on a cruise ship, but it's in space instead of sea. And our team of scrappy covert operatives from the Commonwealth, which is one of the two superpowers in this galaxy, have to track down a mysterious artifact that could shift the balance of the war. And they're worried not only that their opponents, the Illyrican Empire, which is the other superpower, might be after it, but also the starliner is owned by a notorious gangster and crime lord. And so they have to steal it out from under her nose while avoiding their rivals, and many hijinks ensue.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of a Mission Impossible story.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the vibe I go for. I love having a good team of people who've all got their strengths, and you know, occasionally they've got a little bit of friction and there's some conflict within it. And there's some ongoing storylines I'm trying to tease out a little bit in this one. I introduced a new team member who you alluded to earlier, who is in part named after Dorothy Sayers. And she proves to be kind of has a little bit of a trouble fitting in perhaps to the group. She's a little bit more reckless, a little bit more unpolished than some of the other team members. And I think it provides a good dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah, especially given that the team is kind of reeling from what happened in the previous book.
Yeah, right. And she sort of comes into this not sure of her place, and she's from a different background and all of this. And I think she's a lot of fun to write, too. She's just a very dynamic character. She does a lot of she's like an act first, person think later. And I enjoy that.
Right. Very good stuff. Any hints about are there going to be future books in the series?
I would love to say things, but I'm not able to.
Gotcha.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic about continuing the series. I love these characters, love this world, and you can be assured that I will take any opportunity I can get to sort of jump on that. So I've also written a couple short stories in this world that you can find on my website. dmorin.com, and they sort of fill in gaps in between a couple of the books, and like some of them are mostly like deleted scenes and stuff like that, but they're free.
Right.
Go feel free to download them, give them a read.
Cool. Well, you just gave your contact information, which was my kind of final question.
Yeah, you can find me at dmorin.com. You can find me on Twitter at dmorin. You can find me on Instagram, dmorin. I'm pretty much dmorin everywhere, and I mentioned all my shows up top, so I'm pretty easy and pretty visible.
Cool. I've been enjoying Biff, just because I was glad you expanded out after after Arrow went away.
Yeah, we've been having a lot of fun with that show, and there's a wealth of superhero and TV movies to talk about these days, so yes. Not hurting for material there at all.
Yeah, definitely. No end in sight.
That's right. Goes on forever.
Cool. Well, I think that'll about do it for this episode. So, Dan, I want to thank you so much for coming back on the podcast and talking about your comfort reading.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Cool. All right. I'll talk to you later.